Good evening, friends. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, pleased to welcome you to another edition of Valley Writers Read, where all the stories you hear are written by only folks who reside right here in the Valley. And tonight, I'm pleased to announce that we're in for two great stories. The first one, written by Catherine Johnstone, takes place in Africa. It's entitled Two Surgeries, One Voice. And then our second story is set in the Bay Area and is written by an author we've had on many times, Ed Miller. It's entitled Done Deal. Here now is Lee Murray reading Two Surgeries, One Voice. She'll be followed by Ed Miller reading Done Deal.
Two Surgeries, One Voice. It was good. I was the designated photographer. Being busy with the children would have been enough excitement. However, I would have missed out on a lot of what Ted was doing at the Ile Ife Mission Hospital in West Africa. In all fairness, I think Ted was diving into his work in a far-off country to offset the pain of the profound loss of his beloved sister, Dr. Dorothy Johnstone Smith. If only she were here to see what he was doing. Ted held a clinic 40 miles away in the town of Ondo on Tuesday and Friday. His personal interests made the practice at the Ondo clinic grow rapidly. One Friday evening, Ted expressed with excitement about two Yoruba ladies from the Ondo clinic with huge goiters. He advised them to come to the Ile Ife Hospital for admission the following Tuesday, and he would do their surgeries Wednesday morning. He wanted me to be ready for the biggest surgical event of his young doctorhood. He said, "Kitsy, when these two ladies from Ondo arrive at the hospital, a worker will come to the house and let you know when to take their picture. I want photos of them before, during, and after surgery." No problem. Ted's expertise in giving general anesthesia was greatly appreciated by the doctors, especially Dr. Phil, who was the chief of surgery at the Mission Hospital. Dr. Phil was the most skillful general surgeon Ted had ever seen, and he wanted to learn all he could from such a gifted doctor. Dr. Phil had the nimblest fingers of any surgeon. He could rapidly tie surgical knots single-handedly, equally well with either hand. In the U.S. during the mid-1960s, general surgeons controlled almost all small bleeders with electrocautery, which was not available at the Ife Hospital. Ted told me Dr. Phil was almost as fast with his hands as he would have been if using electrocautery. His technique was fast and accurate. Because Ted liked doing surgery, he asked Dr. Phil one day if he would mind if Ted put the patient to sleep and then turn the anesthesia over to one of the competent Nigerian RNs to bag the patient so he could scrub in with him. Dr. Phil gladly welcomed Ted as his student. Instead of Ted standing and peering over the drapes that separated the anesthesia from the operating field, now the physicians were working together across the operating table. They did many surgeries, from thyroidectomies to hemorrhoidectomies. Soon Ted had his own surgery day every Wednesday. He was quite happy doing his own cases. If a given patient needed general anesthesia, he would put the patient to sleep, intubate the trachea, and set the gauges on the gas machine to the correct amounts. Next, he would turn the anesthesia over to one of the Nigerian RNs, who would squeeze the ventilation bag and frequently call out the patient's blood pressure and pulse during surgery. Then Ted would scrub, gown, and glove and do the surgery. When the surgery was finished, he would return to the anesthesia to wake up the patient. It was powerful for him to be in this position. He was on top of the world. Ted became a proud, self-sufficient, one-man band, certainly an impossible medical accomplishment had he been in the USA. One Tuesday afternoon, I took the Ondo lady's pre-operative picture. The same Tuesday evening, Dr. Phil made his rounds in the open hospital wards. He couldn't help but see Ted's two patients with the huge goiters. It was evident to Dr. Phil that Ted was planning to do these two thyroid surgeries Wednesday morning. That was the day that Dr. Phil would be teaching surgery residents at the medical school in Ibadan. The story goes on. Dr. Phil sent word to Ted to wait until he returned in the afternoon to do the thyroid surgeries so he could help him with these rather difficult and dangerous procedures. Ted told me in a confident, arrogant, and audacious manner he had decided to do the surgeries the next morning by himself as planned. He had no intention of waiting for Dr. Phil. I countered, "It doesn't sound good to me." Ted reasoned, "Well, I've done enough thyroidectomies with Dr. Phil to know I can do these surgeries by myself." Ted was not one to be swayed. I'll review Ted's routine. He puts the patients to sleep, intubates the trachea, sets the gauges on the gas machines to the correct amounts, has the Nigerian nurse squeeze the ventilation bag, and he frequently calls out the patient's BP and pulse status during the surgery. Then Ted scrubs, gowns, gloves, and does the surgery. After surgery, he awakes the patient. Right on time Wednesday morning, Ted sent a hospital worker to let me know doctor in surgery needs photo. I recorded a historic event when I took the picture of my self-sufficient, proud-looking young doctor husband in his glory doing surgery. However, when Ted came home Wednesday evening, he looked wilted and emotionally drained. What had happened to his prideful spirit? He said, "I had a very serious problem in surgery this morning with the first Ondo lady." He told me the surgery went well, except at the very end when he was getting ready to close the surgical wound. A very small capillary bleeder was noted deep in the wound. He thought if only he had an electrocautery, this bleeder could be stopped with one small zap. Knowing that parathyroid glands were located just in back of the thyroid, they could cause very serious medical problems for the patient if disturbed or accidentally removed. This problem needed to be avoided. He thought since the bleeder was so small, it would stop by itself when the wound was closed. However, just in case, a half-inch Penrose drain was placed in the wound to drain off any fluids. Then he applied sterile gauze and tape, which added a little more pressure. After the surgery was over, Ted woke the patient up and sent her back to the ward for a routine post-operative care. When he was about halfway finished with the second patient, someone from the woman's ward came over with an unwelcome message. "Doctor, first surgery patient bleeding too much." Ted told them to bring her to surgery right away. Within minutes, the second surgery was completed. He woke her up and sent her to the women's ward for post-operative care. And now the first patient was in surgery again. Ted knew what the problem was. He should have clamped and tied off the small bleeder instead of worrying about one parathyroid gland when there are several. He put her to sleep and intubated as before. He took out the sutures, opened the wound, and was almost down to the source of the bleeding. Then suddenly, the Nigerian male nurse who was following the patient's anesthesia loudly declared, "Doctor, the pulse is no more!" Quickly, Ted looked over the drapes and noticed the oxygen gauge registered empty. Here he was supposedly the expert in anesthesia, and before starting another surgery, he found himself caught up in the excitement of trying to stop the bleeding, and he had forgotten to check the amount of oxygen present in the high-pressure steel bottle. Immediately, Ted yelled to the nurse monitoring the anesthesia, "Disconnect the anesthesia tube and start blowing into the endotracheal tube with your breath." He did. At the same time, Ted stepped up on a low stool and started external cardiac massage by compressing her chest with his hands. Anxiously, he directed the Nigerian circulating nurse to exchange the oxygen bottle. "Take the crescent wrench hanging from the side of the anesthesia machine and exchange the empty oxygen bottle with a full one." The Nigerian circulating nurse had no idea what Ted was talking about. He could not understand Ted's English. Ted could not stop the external cardiac massage, and the nurse blowing his breath off and on into the patient's endotracheal tube could not stop what he was doing. Then someone asked, "Doctor, do you mean a spanner?" "Yes, yes, take the spanner and exchange the oxygen bottle." Now he was communicating with a Nigerian nurse, but to no avail. The nurse had no idea how to use the spanner, the British word for a crescent wrench, to exchange the oxygen bottles. In the meantime, Ted was vigorously continuing external cardiac massage, while the nurse at the anesthesia end of the table was periodically exhaling his breath into the patient's endotracheal tube and continually checking for a pulse. Of course, his breath was a huge improvement over the straight nitrous oxide which the patient had been breathing when the oxygen ran out. Ted said it felt like this nightmare situation continued for an eternity. There was no sign of resurgence of cardiac activity. Ted was sick with discouragement. He stepped down from the stool, pulled off his gloves, took off his surgical gown, and walked around to the foot of the operating table. The patient was dead. Ted started to leave the surgical room when he heard a definite voice in his head say, "Johnstone, get back up there and continue pressing on her chest." He did, and within a short time, the nurse monitoring the patient's pulse and blood pressure yelled out, "Doctor, the patient has a pulse!" Just then, Ed Moon, the director of nurses at Ile Ife Hospital, appeared looking through the window in the door of the surgical room. Ted yelled for him to exchange the oxygen bottle, which he did in seconds. Now the patient was getting pure oxygen, and her blood pressure was faintly discerned. The patient's surgical wound started bleeding again. Quickly, Ted scrubbed, gowned, and gloved, and stopped the bleeding. His worry now was if the patient was going to have brain damage because of the nitrous oxide ordeal. Would you believe it? The next day, the patient was fine. She was up walking around looking completely normal. However, she did complain of a sore chest. Knowing the complete story, it was a joy for me to take the post-operative picture of the Ondo ladies in the hospital. Ted humbly apologized to Dr. Phil for going against his authority. I believe Ed, the director of nurses, had some in-service education to do, too, to train the locals. Today, Ted sees himself in this past moment of time as being audacious, disrespectful, and careless about someone's life for prideful gain. The voice Ted heard is beyond his understanding. Why would God's Son show his amazing mercy and grace when so undeserved?
Nash climbed into the low-slung Caprice sedan, shot a second glance into the seat behind him, made a quick inventory. Crowded among the trash and ruin were two pairs of Italian slacks, a pair of bomber jackets, a fistful of guest watches, perhaps a dozen gold chains. He muttered something, then moved the visor up and over into its place and slipped the transmission in gear. He had a date. It wouldn't pay to keep her waiting. Nash rolled out of the split-level parking facility at the Sun Valley Mall and hit the freeway going south. Looping down an exit ramp 20 minutes later, the Caprice joined an open, palm-studded avenue of big-box retailers and fast-food restaurants. Fidelity Pavilions, a sprawling quadrangle of major department stores and smaller commercial outlets, rose into view. Nash rounded its perimeter and crossed one of the far-flung backlots. Behind an auto center, he found a place and parked. He sat there, drumming his knuckles on the wheel. One of the kids in the garage looked his way and looked again and motioned. The kid left the rack where he'd been bucking Michelins and came out. "This is a fire lane," the kid said, dusting his gloves. Nash took him in. Acne vulgaris and a soul patch. "My bad," he replied. He pulled forward, stopped by a dumpster, switched off the engine. He waited. Lena didn't show. Nash tried her cell, but it kept rolling to voicemail. The service manager, clipboard under his arm, now shifted an interest in Nash's direction. The kid was at his side, talking, gesturing. A patrol car slid by, motored to the end of the store. "Can I help you, sir?" Nash gave a start. The service manager smiled, his elbow on the roof of the Caprice. "I'm waiting for somebody," Nash said. "Mm-hmm. The old lady. Your wife? She must have caught a ride. Maybe she did. Guess I'm in Dutch." Nash eased the Caprice away, idled down a row of empty spaces, and stopped again. He contemplated the patrol car and the unmarked exit where it sat curbside. The door snapped open and a small commotion spilled onto the sidewalk. A scrum of cops and clerks and loss prevention types, profanities, and a spot of bother. Lena was in the middle of it, in handcuffs. Nash eased out again and circumnavigated a flock of teenage girls, then moved slowly around the patrol car. Lena stared gloomily from the back seat behind the cage. Their eyes met. Nash shrugged. "Que pasa?" The commute through downtown Oakland was the usual foobar. Someone's false move had made a goat rodeo of the 880. A sideways Malibu sat smoldering, hung memorably on the center divider. Beside it, a half-demolished LeBaron shared space with a jackknife Kenworth. Under a tarp nearby, a body lay lately defenestrated. Other cars and trucks were strewn about, oil and glass and gasoline, flashing lights, tow trucks and emergency vans. Nash sat in the fumes and death, crawling forward now and then as traffic accordioned its way north. America was a tough town. Nash parked on the street below the Meredith, the ghetto hotel he and Lena called home. On the third floor, they shared a disheveled and windowless two-room studio. They'd been evicted from better, from worse. Nash hauled everything upstairs in bags and sacks and boxes. He unlocked a series of deadbolts, let himself in, and dumped it all on the floor. Leaving it in the car would have been unthinkable. The town was full of thieves. Down to the lobby he went again, and from there pondered his next move. He called the courthouse. A bail hearing had not been calendared, but Nash could do the math in his head. A third strike would run the meter off the scale, and this was Lena's third strike. The line between petty theft and grand, the line that represented the difference between misdemeanor and felony, the difference between jail and so long, Lena had blown past that and taken a victory lap. Nash knew, what's more, no bondsman in town would take action on Lena. She'd burned her bridges with that crowd long ago. She was SOL. He'd have to go all in and hope for the best. Maybe a skilled defense attorney could bend the curve in her favor. Maybe pigs would fly. Nash consulted his contact list, went up and down, found the name he wanted, and hit send. It rang, kept ringing. Someone answered. "Talk to me." "Omar, who's this?" "It's me, dude, Nash." Nash, the tone softened. "What up?" "I came across some merchandise. I'd like to turn it." "Lost and found?" "And you found?" "Yeah, leather jackets, some other..." "I can't help you." "What do you mean, as in no way?" "Hold on. I'm too popular right now. The feds are all up in my business. I can't move anything, can't touch anything. It's hopeless." "Don't say that, Mar. Don't be that way. This stuff's way fine. Dog, you're not listening. Nike sweats, gold chains, stud earrings, the whole pimp parade you so adore." "We closed." Nash set his jaw. "What's an honest citizen supposed to do?" "My check with the ambassador," Omar said. "The ambassador?" "That's what they call him, the ambassador. He's up in Richmond. We've traded off and on, now and then. He's good people. He can handle anything you throw at him. You want an address?" Nash paused a second. "Yeah, shoot." Nash took it down, said okay, and snapped the phone closed. Beyond the Golden Gate, the sun's leave-taking phantomed its way through low, windswept clouds. Nash was a wheel, a trunk full of plunder attended his journey, tags and tickets attached. Designer bling, lately boosted. Nash figured to cover the nut with enough left over for life's necessities. He dodged off the first chute into Richmond, following Omar's directions, then plunged onto a dark back street. He drove some more, winding downhill. At the bottom, the road turned and Nash halted. He idled the car a minute, exhaust chuffing. Then he wheeled around and came back up again. Farragos of wrecking yards, trash-strewn lots, and derelict houses ranged along both sides of the street. Where was this rat hole anyhow? His compass had abandoned him. 202 Pike Avenue. An old craftsman-style bungalow, the house had blacked-out windows and security bars and was set back from the street. Nash pulled into the yard. Another house, a smaller one, nondescript, sat behind the first. He killed the motor. A man came out and stood on the porch. You lost? Omar said I should look you up. He closed the car door behind him. Omar, the man said, tilting his head slightly. Omar Nariz? Yeah, said he'd done business here, with you. A muscle shirt hugged the man's torso, and his biceps confirmed a fellowship with the iron pile. The man mused. Said to see me, huh? You're the ambassador, right? Nash made the front fender his leaning place, propped a boot heel against the tire. The man looked around. Another man appeared. The ambassador's out of town, the man said. Gone away for a while, but we work together. Thought I'd talk to the ambassador. Just leave your card then. I'll have his people call your people. He stepped off into the yard. Nash digested the turn of events. He didn't have a lot of options. We cut from the same book, the man continued. I'm Ruli. He offered a fist bump and Nash returned it. All right, Nash said. I brought some trade. Let's check it out, the man said. Affirmative that, the second man said and trailed down from the porch. What's in the wizard's hat? Nash cleared his throat. A few things, he replied. Jackets, jewelry, bit of a potpourri. Nash popped the trunk. A third man came onto the porch. Bernard, the first man said, give Dre a hand here while me and... What was your name again? Nash. As in the little Nash Rambler went beep beep? No, I'm not even sure what that means. Beep, 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 beep. The man wore the grin of a jackal, and his dental work glinted in the half-light. Bernard, your attention, please. Me and Nash Rambler are taking a meeting. He showed him the way. After you, he said. Nash glanced over his shoulder. Bring it on back where we can get a look at it, the man said. The others set to their task. I won't take less than seven, Nash said, and at once regretted having tipped his cards. As they walked, their shadows rose and fell along a lean-to cedarwood fence that stretched to the rear of the property. In a while, everything was portaged and shifted into the backyard and arranged under the luminous flood of a security light. Jackets, pants, coats, handbags, stereos, watches, jewelry... Swag. The night settled into character and the wind rose from the bay, advanced, extended its long reach inland. It was cold. Maybe I'll go four bills, the man said. Nash left his hands in his pockets and stamped his feet to get the circulation going. I don't see it, he said. Appears we have a difference of opinion, the man said, revolving a gemstone bracelet. Asked evaluation, that is. He let it drop. His men angled poker-faced glances at one another. Nash picked up an identical bracelet. Get real, he said. These wholesale 50 apiece easy. You're fixing to disrespect me, the man said. I'd advise against it. I'm not going there, Nash said. Not at all, but let's say five then and say a tank of nitrous. Nash's eyes narrowed in bemusement. Laughing gas, he said. Say two tanks. Giggle like a little girl. What are you, a dentist? No disrespect, of course. Write it like a tsunami, boy. The man dipped and bobbed as if a surfer shooting the curl. I need cash, Nash explained. I have a legal situation. The man returned an inquiring look. Female trouble, Nash said. Ah, the man said. Who'd she kill? It's a long story. These are the ways of the world, the man said. Where women are concerned, ours is not to question, but to stand in awe and wonderment, and preferably out of the line of fire. The man continued. As to our present transaction, he said, we shouldn't allow perfection to stand in the way of necessity. I'll go six, against my better judgment. But Nash stalled on the number. Tick-tock, the man said. Nash was boxed into a corner, and he knew it. The end game had run its course. I'm about to rescind my generous offer, the man said. The art of negotiation has lost its glamour. Nash threw in the towel. Six it is, he said. So be it, the man said. Call me a white trash charity, why not? He headed toward the little house. Let's visit the ATM, he said. Let's get you taken care of. Up the steps he went. He left the door open. The other two followed Nash. He stopped at the porch. They walked by him. On the porch, one leaned one way on the railing. The other leaned the other way. They didn't look at each other. They didn't look at anything. In the shadows, the man waited. Lights? Nash asked. Little misunderstanding with a power company. Come on in. He approached the doorway. Got your giddy up right here. A squeak, the clang of a box lid. Nash stood at the threshold. He paused. His mouth was dry. Got it right here. Something had dawned on Nash. Some small thing. The men stirred and unleaned themselves from the railing and exchanged places. Meanwhile, they studied Nash as if making an appraisal, as if they were in the moment. A wave of vertigo or transient nausea swept over Nash. He worried a quick thumbnail along his bottom lip, shot a second glance into the coiled darkness, weighed his chances. Almost forgot, he said. Got a Rolex I want you to see. Come on, the voice pooled invisibly before him. Beauty pageant winner, Nash said. World class. Let me get it. Nash backed off the steps and walked around the side of the front house, headed straight for the car. The two men followed. Rolex, huh? One said. Yeah, Nash replied. A Submariner, one of a kind of thing, like I said. Diamond bezel, perpetual date, all the bells and whistles. A real stunner. He reached the Caprice and opened the rear door on the driver's side. He leaned in, far in, and snatched the door closed with a bang and locked it, locked the remaining doors, and scrambled into the front seat. Hey, cousin, one of the men said. Where you going? He pounded on the door window. Pounded harder. Get out of there. Let's go meet Jesus. Glass exploded across the seat. But Nash had already gunned the Caprice to life, and now he fishtailed it out of the yard, the two men clinging savagely to the old sedan, one straddling the hood and the other swearing and clutching Nash's collar and trying to haul him headfirst over the door sill. Nash blew the Caprice through a waggled row of mailboxes and, with a sickening swerve, cartwheeled the men into a wall of thorn bushes that grew roadside beyond the house. And it continued, the Caprice, launching over a curb and into the street with a squall and drift of rubber, furious sparks and heaving motor. In his rearview mirror, Nash saw the first man again, Ruli. The man was grinning viciously, holding a maul. "Son of a bitch," Nash said. "Omar." Nash cleared the top of the hill and began to look for a way out of Richmond. On the freeway south, he watched the headlights of oncoming cars purl and wheel like earthbound stars working upstream against a river of night. Nash was tired, spent, used up, as if his ribcage had been opened and everything removed. Even the bay seemed some lion creature, black and ominous, rolling slowly in its lair. As he approached the first interchange, his cell lit up, buzzed like a viper. That would be her, the main squeeze, she who must be obeyed. The labyrinth of overhead signs disappeared behind him. Nash couldn't remember which way to go.
And so, there you have it. Two stories that couldn't be much different, both in subject matter and certainly in location. The first story, entitled Two Surgeries, One Voice, by Catherine Johnstone, took place in West Africa. It's about Dr. Ted, a surgeon, who probably should have waited a day or so to perform operations on two patients with large goiters, which, by the way, are enlarged thyroid glands, so that he could get the assistance of his mentor, a fellow surgeon by the name of Dr. Phil. But because he didn't wait, and because of an excessive amount of bleeding and the unexpected failure of the operating room's oxygen system, at one point Dr. Ted actually believed that one of his patients had passed away. But luckily, at the very end of the story, we learn that the doctor succeeded in helping the patient he thought he had lost and gave her the strength to recover. Oh, a second story took place in the Bay Area, thousands of miles from the first one. It's all about the life of an on-again, off-again criminal type named Nash. We first meet him when he saw his girlfriend Lena being arrested outside of a shopping mall. It looked like she got picked up for theft. This would be her third strike, so Nash realized it would take a lot of money to get her out of this jam. That's when he called Omar, a buyer of stolen property, who told him to contact the ambassador in Richmond. So, with a car full of contraband, he heads over to Richmond, but instead of buying what he brought, the ambassador's henchman took all of his goods and nearly succeeded in beating him up. No, we never found out what happened to him, but suspect it's all heading in the wrong direction. Friends, we want to thank both of these fine writers for their stories tonight. As you probably remember, we've had on Ed Miller many times and are always taken by his interesting characters and fine background descriptions. And as far as Catherine Johnstone is concerned, well, this is the first time we've had her on, and we certainly hope that both she and Ed Miller will send us more of their stories in years to come. And so we come to the close of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our writers will be Ed and Jacqueline Hibbler. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story. Until we meet again, good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.